This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The U.S. is the richest democracy in the world with the most poverty. Yet neither major party candidate has made more than a glancing reference to programs that aid the poor. It was during another presidential election back in 1976 when then-Governor Ronald Reagan stamped aid with the rapacious Welfare Queen.
The trail extends through 14 states. She has used 127 names so far, posed as a mother of 14 children at one time, seven at another, signed up twice with the same caseworker in 4 days, and once while on welfare, posed as an open-heart surgeon, complete with office.
The woman he described was a serial criminal who bilked the system and racked up tens of thousands of dollars in government aid. And the image stuck. Welfare Queen came to be code for dependent, urban, and black, for the most part. The typical welfare recipient is actually rural and white. Rachel Black and Alita Sprague together looked at the legacy of the Welfare Queen on Policy for the Atlantic and wrote, "The Welfare Queen is a Lie." Rachel and Alita, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having us.
Ronald Reagan gave Welfare Queen a name, but it stuck. Now, did he ever say black woman, or is that just how people understood it?
This is Rachel. In that interview itself, he never identified the race of the woman, but he did in other contexts. You know, when he was governor of California, he bemoaned the disintegration of the black family and the role that he assigned welfare in displacing men in that family. So it wasn't specific to that context, but he had very efficiently laid the groundwork for people to come to that conclusion.
So when did the idea of a welfare recipient become racialized?
This is Alita, and I think that that goes back to the New Deal, to when these programs really were first initiated, which is a really, you know, important moment for the development of anti-poverty programs. But I think it's also important to note that, you know, the Social Security Act specifically excluded domestic work and agricultural labor from Social Security eligibility. And these were industries that relied heavily on black men and women. The act also gave substantial discretion to states in their administration of aid to dependent children, which is the precursor to AFDC and now TANF, which is the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, what people are generally referring to when they say welfare. So from a very early stage in the development of these programs, there are groups of people who were explicitly excluded, and states were also given a lot of leeway to exclude people at the local level. And this had really racialized implications that shaped the trajectory of the programs for decades to come.
So how is that kind of racialized identity of welfare recipients reinforced?
I think it was a process, I mean, a long historical process. You know, I think as the Great Migration progressed and more black families were moving out of the South, we started seeing this backlash really begin. And advocates tried to counter that by emphasizing the participation of white families in these programs, which is a similar tactic that Lyndon B. Johnson employed when he was trying to galvanize support for the war on poverty. You know, I think a lot of us have seen those images of sort of the white, rural, poor in Appalachia that were used to really get support for the reforms he wanted to implement. But in the years following those reforms, we saw a dramatic shift in these portrayals. And the issue of poverty in black communities went from being virtually erased in media to actually being overrepresented. There's actually a political scientist named Martin Gillens who's done a really interesting study on this, and he's shown that in 1964, only 27% of photos that were accompanying stories about poverty in some of the top news magazines in the country featured black subjects. But just 3 years later, it rose to 72%. So this was sort of this moment where poverty was becoming really racialized in the public imagination. At the same time, we had the development of the National Welfare Rights Movement, which was you know, a movement really led by women of color receiving welfare who objected to the stigmatizing practices within the welfare system, the low benefit levels, and they called for basic income as a right that was not tied to work. And this movement had some real victories, but in the 70s, it was really set back by some legal decisions and also some backlash from the public as a result of a broader economic downturn.
And when did it become genderized or always associated with women?
That's a good question. I mean, initially there were mothers' pensions that were given to women to enable them not to work, you know, to stay home with their children and sort of recognizing that itself was work. But we saw this shift in the 50s and 60s placing more work requirements on people receiving assistance. So that's been a pretty dramatic shift over the past century in the orientation of these programs. TANF today has extremely strict work requirements and sanctions for participants who do not comply with these requirements. So we've gone from, you know, helping to subsidize women who are staying at home with their children to requiring them to meet these pretty strict work requirements and balance that with their role as often single mothers.
And was that the result of the Welfare Reform Act? This was the Bill Clinton program of 1996 that put forth work requirements in order to receive welfare.
The welfare reform in 1996 both instituted these strict work requirements. It also imposed a 5-year cap on the lifetime receipt of benefits, and it changed the legal status of the program. So TANF funds are now delivered to states through a block grant, which makes it much more discretionary. So it's not that all families who qualify on the basis of their income can now receive benefits. States have a lot more discretion because they just receive a set amount of funding each year.
We're talking with Rachel Black and Alita Sprague. Both of them work with New America. They've done a lot of research on who is receiving quote-unquote welfare, various forms of aid to the poor and aid to poor families today, and found that the sticky image of who the welfare queen is, how she lives, and even where she lives, is a lie. We do hear a lot of these stories of abuse. Actually, in my limited little world, have seen evidence of taking advantage of government aid. They're attention grabbing. It's an easy argument against dependency. So how do you answer those kind of arguments?
This is Rachel. You know, first I would say that it's very important to have a holistic consideration of who receives government support. And we spent a very disproportionate amount of time and attention focusing on people who receive support via public assistance programs like TANF or like food stamps, and very little attention on people who receive other forms of government support, especially through the tax code. There's about $500 billion a year that's distributed through the tax code for things like owning a home or paying for college or other kind of wealth-building activity, in addition to supporting the growth of existing wealth like capital gains. Most of the fraud through the system comes through that platform, through underreported income and other kinds of loopholes. And it's important to conceptualize waste, fraud, and abuse really in all the forms that it ends up appearing in government spending, rather than aiming attention and reforms at the places where it occurs. For recipients at the higher end of the income spectrum, we end up focusing on where it occurs at the low end of the income spectrum. And I think this speaks, you know, pretty squarely to who we feel like is deserving and undeserving of support.
Do you think that perception, the idea of the abuser, has affected policy and decisions that, as Alita was saying, states make about who qualifies for or, quote, deserves aid?
Well, this is Rachel again, and that's certainly true, and this is absolutely true if you just look at the numbers of people who are actually receiving cash welfare. You know, at this point, participants have dwindled, and most families who would otherwise be eligible for support are no longer able to access this. And this really comes via the funding structure that Alita talked about earlier. States have discretion on how They allocate resources for cash welfare, and really less than half of the block grants that go to states, less than half of those resources actually reach families in the form of cash. You know, frequently the resources are diverted for other uses. Oftentimes this is for the child welfare system. There have been instances where they've gone for scholarships for higher income students, for marriage training classes. There are an abundance of uses for these resources that are not directly going to put money into the pockets of vulnerable families.
Yeah, it sounds like the most vulnerable are getting hit. You, Rachel, mentioned the putting money into marriage training programs. A number of states now prohibit families from receiving benefits if a new baby is born while the household is receiving assistance. This idea that, you know, it's a disincentive for poor women to want to marry and an incentive to have more children. Alita, can you bring up some of these examples of how that kind of thinking about the poor as being of poor character becomes a sort of benchmark for distributing aid?
Sure. So I think this is something that there are numerous examples that we've seen even now in 2016. You know, I think even though the infamous Reagan speech where he described the welfare queen was now 40 years ago, this idea and this mythical welfare recipient he's described has really been shaping our welfare policy ever since. And, you know, the example you mentioned is one of them. There are 15 states that still prohibit families from receiving a slightly higher benefit level if a new child is born while the family is receiving assistance, and there's evidence that this just directly hurts children. There are also quite a few states that now require drug tests for applicants to public assistance programs, even though there's little evidence that rates of drug use are any higher among low-income people than among high-income people. Another aspect of this that we've been looking at in our work is just the very ways that benefits are delivered. Compared to many other countries, the U.S. puts a lot of emphasis on in-kind benefits versus cash benefits. And as Rachel mentioned, the proportion of families receiving cash assistance has dropped dramatically from 1996. It's dropped from 68% of families in poverty in 1996 to 23% in 2014. Even as we've seen deep poverty among families increase. There's also been important research recently from Catherine Eden and Luke Schaefer showing that the number of families surviving on less than $2 a day in cash in the United States has more than doubled over the past 20 years.
Wow, that's like a figure from, you know, the developing world.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. And then even for the very low levels of cash benefits families can receive, we've recently seen new federal restrictions on where and how they can access these benefits that are really based in stereotypes rather than evidence. And I'd also just like to note that, when we're thinking about fraud and waste, we should think about it at a broader level, because what some of these types of restrictions have resulted in is a substantial amount of state resources going towards enforcing these restrictions that really aren't evidence-based.
That was Alita Sprague. She's program fellow at New America. And Alita, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We also heard from Rachel Black, who is senior policy analyst at New America. Rachel, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
They are co-authors of The Welfare Queen is a Lie, which they wrote for The Atlantic. You'll find a link to read the article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.